Music from Stephen Curtis Chapman, I Will Be Here. We heard from Mary Catherine before that, her song Savior, and from Fernando Ortega, Prayer for Home. And good morning to you, 15 and a half after the hour on this Broken Road Radio Monday morning. We're joined by Dr. Don Clark from Garden Valley, Texas. Don, good morning. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Jim. Good to be with you this morning.
Well, how'd the seminar go?
Oh, it was excellent. It was just a lot of information. We met a lot of folks in the wine industry.
This
or just
is a wine
starting
and wine
like
and
we
grape
are.
Seminar. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. We had several sessions. Of course, there were fairly large representation from the vendors, and so we spoke to a lot of vendors. And spoke to a lot of experts and spoke to a lot of folks that are just starting up like we are.
Well, you know what? Maybe you'll have some recommendations then for Heike, because we just learned from Heike that she has tried to grow grapes, although not with a great deal of success. Heike Dodge is with us this morning. She's a mother and a very busy lady from central Minnesota. Heike, what, three kids plus two foster kids plus two businesses that you help run with your husband? And a yep. hobby farm. How do you do it? And how do you make time for radio interviews?
My husband took a couple of kids with him. The other ones are locked in a back room with some quiet toys. So,
a resourceful lady. Yeah, she knows all the tricks. Heike, you know, just a delight to have you with us. And just to refresh everybody's mind as to how this came to be. You know, we've talked with Dr. Don on the air several times about genetically engineered foods. And some scientific research that says they're a threat, that long term they could be causing problems, not only with the health of people, you know, making a causing a tend toward obesity in kids and so forth. That comes out of a Norwegian study that took 10 years to accommodate, and is not making the news worldwide. It's kind of being hushed, and also the possibility that it actually destroys the soil. And I got to thinking, I know Heike, and I know she has. Should I call it a hobby farm? Is it the right term?
I think some would argue that it's not, but that works for me. It's 12 acres, and we raise some chickens and vegetables, so that's farmish enough for me. It's in the country.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know,
it's a family farm.
There you go. just a little tiny one. Do you have farming in your background? Did you grow up on a farm, maybe?
I do. In fact, I think you'd be hard-pressed to go back any less than maybe seven generations in my family to find someone who wasn't on a farm.
My goodness. And this was in southern Minnesota, I presume.
Yes, I grew up just north of the Iowa border, and I make that distinction because it's important to only those who live just north of the Iowa border.
Uh-huh.
I think there's an Ole and Lena joke involved in why we want to make that distinction. But
well, no doubt. Most of those Iowans...
When grew up on a crop farm, Dad...
I'm just thinking that's really a different climatic zone. Most people think of Minnesota as cold and frigid, but there is an arm of in the climate maps that creeps up into southern Minnesota, and it's exceptionally rich soil and a great place to farm, isn't it?
Yes, actually, the county that I grew up in is some of the richest soil in the nation, and also some of the most expensive for farmland. My dad grew soybeans and field corn, and then also there was a canning factory down the road, so we raised canning sweet corn and sweet peas for the canning factory. But then during the summer, my dad would take off with his and his brother's combines and head south and would cut wheat for wheat farmers in the wheat belt. So I've had it from just about every end.
It's almost kind of a nomadic existence. Do you ever go with him?
Oh, yeah. Couple summers in my high school years, I was the chief cook and bottle washer, which was a baptism in and of itself, because I didn't know how to cook when I started. But I'd take the meals out to the hired crew, and I liked that because I could hop on the combine and run around in the field cutting wheat while they were eating, and I felt like I was a pretty cool kid running a very big machine.
Well, what took you off the farm? Was it getting married? Was it college? Was it what?
College, and then, yeah, life and marriage and all that kind of stuff. And then when my husband and I had children, we were living in a city of just under 100,000, and I just felt claustrophobic. I had lived in Oklahoma City in previous years, but I didn't have children, and I was, you know, young and experiencing the big wide world, and that was adventurous. But when it came time to have a family, I just had a very sudden reaction that I was claustrophobic having neighbors that close, and I wanted to get back to the country. And my husband agreed, and so we started looking for a little plot of land, and the rest is history.
Did he have farming in his background?
He grew up in a small town in central Minnesota, but he was what I call a town kid. But he did have cousins that had a farm just outside of town. He's baled his fair share of hay. He's milked a few cows. So. Okay.
But basically, you've taught him everything he knows then.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a great debate at our house as to who really owns the tractor.
Well, who's on it the most? That's the determining factor.
In the winter, he does all the snow clearing, except when he has to get to work early, then I do the snow clearing. But in the summer, I use the tractor to move hay bales around and to clean out the chicken coop and things like that. So
Heike, when you got this urge to go back to a small, you know, less densely populated area, did you have farming in mind, raising food for your family, or did that come later?
Gardening, I think, was always on the agenda, but just vegetable gardening. The chicken thing happened because my son was diagnosed with celiac disease, which is a intolerance to gluten. Gluten is found in wheat, rye, and barley. And as I began reading labels and trying to gluten from his diet, I came to the realization that they used wheat or barley malt to fill foods that had no business being filled with that kind of stuff, like chicken broth, for instance. You would think chicken broth would be chicken broth and salt and a little vegetable, and that would be it. But no, they were sticking wheat in chicken broth. So I started making my own broth, and then I started with a few backyard chickens, and it's kind of snowballed.
Well, now tell us about your farm. You're in the Little Falls area of central Minnesota, and again, this is what, 11, 12 acres?
Yep, I have 12 acres, and it was a hay meadow, and in our part of the county, it's very clay soil, and it's very rocky. You can't grow robust crops like, you know, say sweet corn or something like that. Really, you raise stuff for silage for your cows, because that's the best use for this type of ground. So when I started my garden in this clay rocky soil, it didn't go well at first, and it seemed to be just a horrible battle. And I was at the point where I was going to have to take Roundup and just blast everything and start fresh. And I didn't like that idea. So I started researching options for an above ground garden. And that's when I came across the square foot gardening method, which is building boxes and mixing your own soil comparable to something you would buy in the store at a very high price. Mm-hmm. But mix your own using, I use my chicken manure and I use compost, and I buy bags of peat moss and vermiculite. Mix the dirt once, and then all you have to do is just refresh it in spring.
Well, that brings up an aspect I wanted to ask you about, and Dr. Don, I'm sure you'll be interested in this too as a grower of grapes now, but farming is kind of a symbiotic relationship of different processes, isn't it? You can use byproducts of your main products to help supplement other areas of the farm. You mentioned chicken manure. I've got to tell you my favorite joke. I was on the air down at KJLY in Blue Earth one day and I was doing news, and there was a story about a new factory in North Carolina that was entirely powered by chicken droppings. And it was started by a guy from Minnesota who had learned how to do it here. And so I looked at the news guy and I said, you know what, this is an example of a genuine, honest to goodness Minnesota entrepreneur.
Oh. And it went I think chicken manure is a very untapped resource. I think we could do a lot more with it, not just in terms of, you know, reconciling soil, but I think there are a lot of things we can do with chicken manure.
Well, it's about not wasting anything, isn't it? And compost, I guess, from vegetable scraps and table scraps and the like. Do you do that too?
I do, actually. During the canning season, I have a couple of neighbors that do a tremendous amount of canning. And every night she brings over a 5-gallon bucket of the scraps and just gladly hands them over to me, because she used to have chickens herself and she's kind of living vicariously through me. And we gladly accept her scraps and feed the chickens. So,
well, are the chickens the major part of your effort, or do you spend more time growing things? Explain the balance of things to us a little bit here.
Okay, in the winter, the only thing I have going is I have about 40 laying hens in a coop and back, and I go out there every day and collect the eggs, and what we don't eat, I sell to my friends and family, and usually I have a waiting list for my excess eggs, because once you've eaten a farm fresh egg, you don't want to go back to the stuff you buy commercially. Mm-hmm. The yolk is yellow and rich, and the flavor is good, and there's more vitamin D in a farm fresh egg. And I think people also like the fact that my chickens get to wander around and eat bugs and grass, and they're happy chickens, and I think happy chickens make happy eggs.
Well, that sounds logical to me.
In the winter, I just have my layers, but then in the spring, of course, I get my garden going, and in a few days, I'll have 100 broiler chicks that'll come in April, and in about 8 weeks, they'll be ready for butchering, and I drive them up to a local processor. It's a family-run Christian business, and I love supporting that business. They butcher them for me with all the USDA certifications. So I then keep what I want to keep and sell the rest to family and friends. And essentially, my surplus pays my feed bill.
I was going to ask you that. Is there an economy in this? In other words, some of your product gets sold, the part that isn't consumed by your family. Is it enough to offset the cost of operating the farm?
I would say yes, it is. I was an English major in college, not a math major, so the calculations are a bit beyond me sometimes. But I do believe that I'm at least paying for my own family's food, that I've reduced my grocery bill. And because this all started when I was a stay-at-home mom, I didn't have an income to contribute to the family expenses. I just had my work. And I figure, even though I might be getting pennies per hour, the effort that I put into it is basically my paycheck getting back in free groceries.
Dr. Don, I'd like your thoughts on the economy of small farming. Do you think Heike's example could be followed generally and that we would all benefit? Or is it simply something from days gone by that's only available to a few now?
Well, I think the key factor here is to have some land. So if the listeners are interested in doing this, and I would highly encourage it because of the direction that we're going as a country, that we learn how to get back to the land. And you don't need a lot of land to do postage stamp gardening, and I don't know how much surface area you're actually covering there. But a little bit of land produces a lot as far as fruits and vegetables are concerned. And so the chickens, well, they obviously take a little more, especially if you're going to free range them like you're doing, Heike. But I would definitely encourage folks to get into a business like this, whether you butcher your own chickens and use the meat all year round. It takes a lot of chickens to do that, depending on the size of your family. But overall, it's a great idea.
Heike, could you do the same thing on less land?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's a movement right now towards tearing up your front yard lawn and converting it into vegetable gardens, because really, it seems kind of idiotic to grow grass, fertilize it, water it just so you can cut it. You waste gas, you put pollution into the air. And does anybody have time to sit and enjoy their lawn anyway?
Good question.
I love the idea of ripping up your front yard and making it a beautiful vegetable garden with walking paths. You can, be sitting in amongst the pumpkins with your little cup of coffee on your bistro set. I think that is a much more logical way to have a half acre in town, for instance. And there is an urban chicken movement. I did a little research yesterday on some of the major cities that have an ordinance allowing a small number of chickens. And if you're just talking about feeding your own family, 4 to 6 chickens is very adequate. But I'm just going to list off some of the big cities that allow chickens: Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York City, Seattle, Portland, Baltimore, and the list is much longer.
Hmm. You know, I think back to when I lived briefly in Norco, California, little small town out east of Los Angeles. They were proud of their horse population. In fact, they used to brag that they had more horses in town than they had people. And and people in this suburban area would chain link, you know, run chain link fence around their quarter acres and keep two or three horses. Unfortunately, there were many times more flies around than there were horses. What do you attract when you have chickens?
Let's see. Well, the chickens eat the flies, so that actually is just recycling that back into the food system. I guess, what do I probably attract some mink, which is a bad thing because I do lose some chickens every year to mink and other predators, fox, that kind of thing. Some of my friends have troubles with owls coming in and swooping down and taking a chicken with them. I've had the most trouble with the neighbor dog, frankly. But I don't really have, I guess, any negatives that have been attracted by my chickens. I know in an urban setting there is concern about the smell, but I've seen some elaborate $2,000 and $3,000 chicken coops that have been built to, it's more like a little playhouse for their child, and a couple of chickens happen to live there. You can go as elaborate or as simple as you want. One of my chicken coops is actually a very ugly fish house, ice fishing house that my husband made for his brother, and his brother smiled and gave it back to him and said, no, thank you. And so we turned it into a chicken coop.
Well, see, all things work together. You know how that saying goes. In raising your food, would you consider yourself an organic gardener? And what does that word mean to you?
Well, for some purists, organic means a lot more than what I am. It may mean, you know, certifications and pure ground for 7 years before you can certify. For me, organic just means that I don't put any unnecessary chemicals in. I don't use any chemical fertilizers. I use my chicken coop to fertilize. Every spring when we de-poop the coop, it goes on to a pile that rests all summer long, and I stir it up, and then in the fall when I do that again, it goes right onto the garden, and it rests. That hot manure needs to rest for a while before you can put it directly into your garden, but I have a system of doing that, and to me that's organic. Giving my chickens my table scraps and not giving them any hormones or any unnecessary chemicals, that's organic to me.
So you watch the feed that you give them. You buy a very particular kind of feed, for example.
I'm not that particular. I do know some people that mix their own. They buy organic wheat and organic corn, and they mix it themselves. I'm not that elaborate. I just don't go out of my way to use the medicated feeds that I don't think are necessary.
Now, when you started doing this, were you, and I'm sure the experience, well, I guess what I'm asking is, did you have to do a lot of study to figure out how to get this done, or was your farm background enough to get you going? You know, how much work is there in educating yourself to the point where you can do this and actually make use of it for your family?
Well, in a world where the internet has answers in 10 seconds flat, it's a great time to be able to start a little venture like this. I grew up on a farm, but by the time I came along, my grandparents had gotten rid of the chickens. I grew up on a multi-generational farm. My grandparents were there with my parents, and my mother was raised on that same farm with her grandparents around. They had a large chicken operation when my mom was small, but that was all gone by the time I came along. So I asked questions of people who knew, and then I got things like chicken raising for dummies. And there are a lot of resources on the internet. There are a lot of magazines too. There's, oh gosh, probably at least a half a dozen periodical magazines that you could subscribe to that are just specifically for chickens or for hobby farms, or small gardens. There's a lot of information out there that you can get.
Don, does this suggest to you that maybe the culture is coming around to make this thing practical again? There's this whole approach to living and providing food for your family with just the front yard in your suburban home. Is that realistic?
Well, I think it's certainly possible, and I think those folks who are looking towards the future certainly will say this is something at least I got to learn, because there may come a time when you go to the grocery store and there's nothing on the shelves. So what are you going to do then? So you know, learning these basic techniques, these growing techniques, as Heike said, is really not that difficult. Yeah, there's some tricks of the trade, but people, we've found in the agricultural field, people are so ready to share their information. All you really need to do is ask, and you get into a community of farmers or like-minded people, and it's very easy. I mean, it's just.
Well,
you know, it's like you say, an ongoing source of.
Yeah, Heike, let me ask this: when we came to Minnesota, and I was raised in Duluth, but not on a farm. In fact, I've had no farm experience. My wife has had a little bit as a little girl down in Kentucky. She would spend summers on her grandparents' farm, so she has all these warm, fuzzy memories about farm life. It's something I've never experienced, always wanted to do. And when we moved here from San Diego many years ago, the idea was hobby farm. The big discouragement was we discovered you still need cash. You still need an income to get by. How does that play on your plans, your farming efforts, and your plans as a family?
Well, my husband will never quit his day job, that's for certain. And actually, in our neighborhood, we have a number of hobby farmers. Some of them work for the state and, you know, they get up early and go to their day job, and either the wife stays at home and does the cow chores in the morning, or the husband does them in the afternoon, and they just work hard on the weekends. They're not people that take a lot of vacations, certainly, but I think for me personally, I look at my friends who live in town and they want to have a cabin retreat on the lake so they can get away from it all, and I always am hesitant to want to go that route because I have nothing to get away from. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love, when I walk out my front door, I am on vacation. The only thing I'm missing really is a lake, and we live in the land of 10,000 lakes, so I'm 3 miles to the nearest lake. I think when a person is passionate about living off the land, and even though you might not be able to support your family solely with that, I think it kind of takes over your life and your choices, and you live it and breathe it, and you're happy to do it, and you're just passionate about it.
Well, it still has a great appeal for me, and you know, I'm in my 60s now, and I'm thinking, you know, you could still experiment with this and learn a lot and have something of the experience yet. Even though my kids are grown and gone, I would wish that experience for them too. How do your kids react to this? Do they, actually, they probably have friends at school whose folks are doing the same thing. What's their take on this experience?
Well, because we live in a rural community and there's a lot of dairy farmers in the area, it's very normal for most people don't live in town in my area. They either live on the farm or grandma and grandpa have a farm and they spend a lot of time on it. So my kids are by no means out of the ordinary for our area. But within our family unit, my children are the only ones that don't live in a big city. And when we get together with family, there is an obvious difference in understanding about our passion for country living versus, you know, those who live in the city. They don't appreciate it. And that's not to say that city living doesn't have its benefits, but our value system and what's important to us kind of is lived out in our country living. And our kids have benefited so much from living in the country. Everything from the butchering process of chickens, because we have butchered in front of them and they've learned what the inside of a chicken looks like, and they've actually been very curious about anatomy and the functioning of the body, and we've been able to literally show them what intestines look like. And, you know, a town kid doesn't get that actual experience.
Yeah, David, you know, David, cover your ears, would you?
Uh-huh. What? I grew up on a farm. What
did
do you mean?
You grew up on a farm? Where?
Oh, near Bertha, Minnesota. Okay. It's a town probably 50 miles west of where we are now. But
they grow a lot of potatoes up there, don't they?
That's true.
Yeah. Well, and the other part of it, too, is that, Heike, you're talking about some of my in-laws, the people that live around you. My wife is a Perleyburg. And so they're all over the place over in that neck of the woods. And many of the people that you're talking about, in fact, they might be some of the same people there, are the folks that own a lot of land or some land. They have their job at the DNR or the Agriculture Department or whatever, and they go in and spend 8-9 hours, and then they come back and do the stuff necessary on the farm evenings and weekends.
Absolutely, and it's a labor of love, and it, you know, sometimes it does get frustrating when you got to trudge out at 20 below and do the chicken chores or milk the cows or whatever, but if you hated it, you'd quit doing it because there isn't a lot of money in it. It's not, you know, you're not going to get rich. It's a labor of love.
Right. Well, and my wife, and she's a city kid now, but, you know, she grew up near Piers, which is
close. That's where I'm at.
Okay, which is close to your neck of the woods. And she said many times, I mean, the reason her parents kept the farm, they're still living on it. They're in their mid-80s now, and they kept the farm primarily because someday they say, we may need a place to feed ourselves. They see the nastiness coming up too. At least, you know, if you're on a farm, you can get a daily meal.
You know, I remember when the economy really started heading south here a few years ago, there was actually talk in you know, the media that there may be food shortages and that there may be, you know, worries about going to the store and being able to buy bread or milk or eggs. And I remember kind of smiling, not for those who didn't have it, but for the fact that I knew that at least I would have eggs and I would have a garden that I could feed my family with. And if I could barter with my neighbors for things, for instance, our farm is essentially a big hay meadow, and one of the neighbors down the road here that is, he works for Minnesota during the day, and at night he takes care of his beef cows. He takes the hay off of my land and gives me a box of meat in exchange, and I like the fact that I don't need to be dependent on a grocery store for everything.
Right. Mm-hmm. So barter enters into this as well. And of course, now you keep records, don't you, for your two businesses, your two optical centers?
I do, yes. I don't keep as good a records for my own gardening. Actually, the most important thing I need to do is just remember what I planted where, so I don't pull it up and think it's a weed.
Yeah. I'm just wondering about the tax implications of this, because I'm really picturing, Dr. Don, you might want to offer some comment on this too. Sociologically, big scale, much of the world still lives this way, maybe under more Spartan conditions. I'm thinking of places in Africa and Asia where people still own a little bit of land or work it for a landowner and participate in the crop, and they're close to the ground, and they understand the seasons, and they can read the stars, and they're just close to the earth and to God's creation. But here in the West, in this country, so many of us have gotten away from that. How would you start a movement to get back to that on an appropriate scale for people who now live in the United States? Is that a pipe dream, or will there be no choice maybe?
No, I don't think it's a pipe dream. I think, like I said before, these skills are something that everybody, you know, should have. You mentioned one of the interesting things you mentioned earlier, that you're in the 60s. How can you start something, you know, being that old or that young?
Either old or young.
Yeah, we started our vineyard, and I'm in my 60s, and so that's a multi-year process. And if we go on to actually build a winery, that's even mm-hmm. a longer term venture. I don't think age really matters here. It's the desire, and it's really looking around, seeing what's happening in the economy. We have one of the ministries we work with, the ministry in Seattle now. They work with orphans in Liberia, for example, and Benin. Agriculture is a must. Even those people who live in let's say, Monrovia, which is the largest city in Liberia, they are finding places to grow anything in order to eat because they have to. They you know, they may not have a job and they need to find a little plot of land, and they start farming it, whether it's alongside of a riverbed or wherever. So even having, you know, a little bit of land is a wise thing to do. And, you know, moving for me, I'm like Heike. I mean, I do not like living in the city. I've lived in the city most of my life. But being out in the country is just so refreshing and so much more relaxing that there's a lot of you know, benefits to it.
If I could just speak for a moment on the movement towards urban farming, there's a really strong movement towards getting food closer to its consumer, and there are truck farms that are sprouting up in the middle of New York City. They're using rooftops of buildings that would otherwise be just a place to create heat, and they're turning them into giant gardens and greenhouses on the top of buildings. And I'm so excited about that for a number of reasons. Number one, people are learning how to be more self-sufficient that way. And number two, they're reducing the travel time from a food getting harvested to the time it gets on someone's plate. And that really excites me.
Well, and I was going to mention in Seattle, there are community farms as well, or at least community plots where you can go and rent, you know, a couple of rows in a field which is in the city, and go and farm. And
absolutely,
you're responsible for taking care of it and for planting and for weeding and for doing, you know, whatever you want to do with it. But yeah, that's encouraging to see too.
Well, this is a fascinating topic, and I think we could go on and on and on, and I'd love to do just that. And Heike, maybe can we get you back another time to do this?
Absolutely.
And Carrie Ann, this is a fascinating discussion, because I may be a bit of a romantic, but I think there's a little bit of farm in all of us. That's our history in this country. And I think there's still enough know-how around, kind of a collective memory. It's kind of in our genes. And if we can learn to adapt it to where we live now, where we are now, you don't need to go get 40 acres. You don't need to homestead 160. You can maybe use your front yard and just learn to network with other people doing the same thing, trading skills. And if you don't own land, maybe you can help work a garden for someone who does. And it'd be interesting to see if that system can be worked out. There's a lot of dollars at stake, a lot of huge industrial interests that'll have to find something else to do. It means really retailoring the whole of society. So a subject well worth our time. And Dr. Don, Heike Dodge, thank you very much for joining us this morning. It has been a blessing.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's been, it's been fun again. Once again, thank you.
And music from...
Continues to be a good time.
Yeah. Les Stahl at the piano continues the music on A Broken Road Radio Monday morning. Good morning to you.